consecutive time in the last six seasons, the Dutch are the champions.
This is Gary O'Neill to win it.
They've got it! Terrific header, Callum Robinson, super ball in.
Great feeling, we have to treasure these nights.
Well, hello there. This is the RTE Soccer Podcast. James O'Toole is on the line. Coming up in this, the 12th edition of the 2020 RTE Soccer Podcast, Alan Matthews of the St. Patrick's Athletic Management Team on the decision to lay off players. Alan, along with Barry Ferguson, will look back on the 2003 and 2004 Cup Finals when Longford Town won back-to-back trophies. Last week brought the sad news of the passing of Dave Bacuzzi, who was part of a great Cork rivalry in the 70s between Cork Hibs and Cork Celtic. We'll be remembering the days of Turner's Cross and Flower Lodge and even Albert Rovers. Well, James, how are you doing?
Not too bad, Adrian. How are you? The weather has been absolutely fantastic, really, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And I gather the work on your house is still ongoing as we speak.
It's not going. It's not ongoing, it's more not going.
No. Well, you're very bright and cheery despite all that. Quiet enough on the football front. June 19th, of course, remains the date that people are targeting. We'll have to wait and see. That's the scheduled return, a little over 7 weeks' time. But, of course, the coronavirus, COVID-19, maintains its grip on so much of the world. Last week, St. Pat's became the latest club to lay off players and coaching staff. Sligo Rovers and Cork City had taken similar action several weeks ago. With us now, Alan Matthews, who's part of the football management team and is also on the board of directors at St. Pat's, and also our own soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue. Alan, first of all, in the club's statement announcing the layoff of players and coaching staff, there were a couple of lines which read, "We have up to now maintained everyone in employment. However, it's impossible for us to continue to do this when it is now uncertain that football and our budgeted income stream will resume at any time this year." I guess reading that and looking at uncertainty and any time this year, and the fact that St. Pat's have taken the action just 7 weeks or so out from what should be the resumption of the league, we'll have to wait and see. Would it be fair to say that you do not now see, as a club, St. Pat's do not now see June 19th as a viable returning date for football?
Yeah, I think that's fair, Adrian. We all hope that it is. And if it is, and we're proven to be incorrect, happy days. We'll do it, you know, gladly. Roll back in and resume training with a view to kicking back. But in taking on board medical advice and just around what's going on in the country and the way everybody is in a lockdown scenario, and for us to kind of contemplate coming back in June, we don't think it's something that's going to be feasible, along with a number of other clubs. And at best, I think we're looking at some stage in the autumn. I know September has been mooted, and I think it was followed up with a couple of scenarios the other day released by the FAI, and one of them being a resumption of football in September. As I said, if we're proved to be incorrect and we actually come back earlier, brilliant. But unfortunately, we don't think that's the case, and a very, very tough decision was taken to make that call last week. And be ready and enable us to be ready when we do come back.
Tony, I guess we simply don't know. Everybody has to wait on the advice of the HSE and government officials before moving on any front. But you're regularly in contact with lots of football people. What's your read of the situation as it stands now?
Unfortunately, I'm afraid, health advice has to come first. And as difficult a decision as it must have been for St. Pat's, I think that's a decision that club boardrooms around the country had to face into as well. We know that Cork City and Sligo Rovers were the first League of Ireland clubs to announce wage cuts. But then Cork City changed that in a way. They availed of the COVID-19 wage subsidy scheme. And as I understand, I think almost all the clubs are in one shape or form availing of that now. All the clubs in the Republic of Ireland jurisdiction, certainly. It's a public health issue. And it's 8 weeks, I think, now since St. Pat's last played a league game. And talking to Tom O'Mahony, their president, during the week, I mean, they've had virtually no income in that time. They were, you know, hemorrhaging money. And it didn't look like a resumption date was going to happen any time soon. So there's like huge uncertainty around the future of football in this country. The FAI talking about that September date, I think they're hoping, as we look at, you know, Germany back in training, and the prospect perhaps of football happening in September. I think that's a wish list in terms of the FAI. They desperately want international football in particular to come back, so that they can, you know, get some badly needed income. Their financial viability is at stake, as we know it has been in these dramatic times. In the last 12 months, it's been an extraordinary time for them. But I think even if international football were to come back in September, I can't see it being in, you know, a full Aviva stadium. There would have to be huge restrictions. And again, speaking to Tom O'Mahony last week of St. Pat's, I have to say Richmond Park Stadium of Light, one of my favourite grounds in the league. But, you know, it will be very hard. That has a capacity of approximately 5,000. It will be very hard for, you know, them to organise people in and out of that ground safely while keeping the social distancing, you know, while having regular hand washing, etc., etc. So, I mean, these are the issues that must come first ahead of football. We would all want football to recommence. And for the clubs in the bigger leagues and the bigger television deals, you can see why the clubs want to honour the contract in a sense to get that millions of TV money. But nonetheless, you know, for a league like ours, which doesn't have the same TV income, that's not as big a deal as you know, doing the games not with a crowd in the stadium, behind closed doors almost. I mean, you know, the match day income is the main income for most clubs, either the gate receipts or the ancillary match day income, you know, what you would get, you know, on the night in terms of other sales, be it food or drink or program sales or merchandise sales, that sort of thing. So, you know, we're in a rush. We're all determined. We're all anxious to get back. But in a way, what we're seeing this week, even from government, is that maybe, you know, the lockdown restrictions, we can't ease them yet. It's just not feasible for our health. And so football has to take a back seat in that instance.
And Alan, of course, it's a given that it's a very difficult time for players, as so many players who depend, obviously professional players, not getting that wage. Tony mentioned there the government schemes, which several players, you know, from right around the country, hundreds of players are currently availing of. But it is a difficult time, both in terms of financial income for players and, of course, psychologically, like everybody in society, having to deal with the effects of a lockdown.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I mean, it affects everybody, but in so many different ways. We you know, there's a collective with training and with players getting together. There's a routine about coming in every day to train. That's been taken away. It's, you know, it's not really a full replacement whereby you're doing remote work on your own and you're not engaging with your teammates. You're doing it remotely. You're talking on Zoom, you're talking on group chats, etc. So we're trying to make the best of what we can of this situation, and with no specific days to work to keep motivation and to keep the level of enthusiasm up. It's difficult, and in fairness to Stephen and Patrick and Sean O'Connor and PJ, all the guys are linking in together and working out various programs, but also interacting and discussing things about where we can improve between now and when we do come back. But with no specific date, it's very, very difficult to maintain that. And as I say, as Tony said there as well, like it just appears that that's going to be pushed further down the calendar year as we go on. But from a playing point of view, we all want to get back. We all want to get back to training and going and playing again. And we'll be very, very hungry to try and do that when we're given the green light. But there's so many things that have to fall into place before that. And I think people, all people, would respect that we have to do what's right, take your time, and ensure that everybody's health is put to the forefront before any decision is taken, before the football will resume. And as Tony said, we're not in the same position as our colleagues across the way in the UK, where they have billion pound deals, TV deals, and have the capacity to take in people, test them, keep them socially apart within a very confined space to enable matches go behind closed doors. I just don't think that's feasible here. And with the best will in the world, with each club doing their very, very best and putting the best foot forward. I just don't think we could provide those facilities to enable us to meet those health restrictions. So as I say, from all aspects of life, I mean, every industry and every part of this country has been affected by this pandemic and shutdown. We just have to hope that we ride through it and come out the right side in 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 3 months, 4 months, whenever it is, we're given the green light to go again.
I think if it wasn't for those mega TV deals, you probably would see other leagues accepting, like the Dutch Eredivisie, for example, or the Belgian league, that to void the season or to just to finish it. I think the obligation on certain leagues to finish is a contractual one. They want to try and make sure that they can get as much of the TV money as possible. And that to me somehow seems almost a little bit immoral, in a sense that, you know, if it's so dangerous for people's health, I mean, trying to get games behind closed doors, I mean, TV companies need lots of people, perhaps lots more people than fans realise to put a production together. You know, I was reading an article recently where saying, like, what about the ball boys? You know, what about the physios? What about the people that make the food? Where are the players going to be? And if one player unfortunately contracts the virus and then contact tracing, and what happens to the leagues then? I mean, we're reading all sorts of situations today in the English Premier League of the various clubs sharing a hotel that gets, you know, deep cleansed after every team has been in and out of it. But, you know, they all have to be fed and watered. They have to be driven to and from the venues. This is like, we've never been in this territory before, and I don't think the old rules can or should apply as much as we want football to continue or to resume, at least.
The same kind of thing, Tony, if you're talking about that being driven to matches and stuff like that. If you look at, we'll take for instance the away change room at Dalebone Park, like, I don't even think there's 2.5 metres from one end to it to the other end, never mind having a squad of players in there. So that's near on impossible to happen. But from Alan's point of view as well, how long, like, if they say we will be back at this stage, we need at least 4 weeks of pre-season again, I would take it, for your players. Would that not be about right?
Yeah, at a minimum, James, that'd be right. Yeah, you'd 4 to 6, but certainly as a minimum, you'd need 4 weeks minimum to kick on.
Alan, if we reach a scenario in mid-July where we're still in, as Pat's in last week's press release deemed it, uncertain territory, there's a come a point then where we have to bite the bullet and say, look, we'll have to just leave it until next February. And I know nobody wants to look at that scenario, but we had Conor Hoey, the Drogheda chairman, on the podcast last week, and he said that's the worst case scenario. But there must come a point where a big decision will have to be made ultimately, surely.
Yeah, and I think the longer we continue in the current climate, I think the more that particular decision will have to be looked at. And, you know, it's a nuclear option, if you like, where there's no football. But it pales into insignificance in the overall context of where we are at this moment in time. You know, there's still 20-odd, 30-odd people per day passing away. We haven't got a remedy or a vaccine for this virus. HSE are ramping up the testing, I think, from this week. And there's an awful lot of things that, as I say, need to fall into place before we can actually get back and to resume normal life. And unfortunately, football will fall very much down the priority queue in that regard. So I think, yeah, if we come to a situation, I think people would be disappointed, but I think if we could bring some element of clarity to it, that we don't want it to happen. I don't think anyone involved in the game here wants this season to be scrapped. But I think you have to look at the bigger picture and see exactly where football sits. Not priority at this moment in time. People's health, safety of people is, and we have to maintain that. If we come to a situation where we're coming towards the end of the summer, September, and it doesn't look really as if we're going to get back, I think, yeah, at that stage, a bit of clarity and maybe put it to one side and resume whatever type of season we want to early next year might be the best for all. But as I say, I hope that doesn't come to pass. But it could well be the most realistic and logical thing to do.
OK, well, let's move to happier times, shall we? Hey, Alan, 2003, 2004... Longford Town winning back-to-back cups. Let's remind ourselves of what happened in the final in 2003. A 2-0 victory over St. Pat's.
Paul Donnelly, but losing possession. Little Alan Kirby, very skillful on the ball, but lets it go. An early ball downfield for Sean Francis. Francis is a man of goals. He's a top goal scorer in the league. He shows him out at the centre, tries to shoot to goal. Fully got there, it's gone in. Longford have taken the lead. It deflected, but it's gone into the back of the net. And Longford Town have taken the lead. Here go Longford again, in around the back. Alan Murphy striding forward. He's going to lay it on for Shane Barrett. Brings it down, calls it. That could be a penalty. Goalkeeper bringing him down. Barry Ferguson, he missed a penalty in the League Cup final in August against St. Pat's late in the game. What's going through his mind? He strikes it and Addison makes the save. Memories of that night in Inchicore surely haunted Barry Ferguson. He didn't hit the ball with any great conviction. And Adamson, the Pats goalkeeper, diving to his right, makes the save. Shane Barrett, is he going to get his cup final goal? Shane Barrett is going for glory, and Shane Barrett has won the cup for Longford Town. Into the vacant, empty net it goes. And Barrett, with the 3 minutes of stoppage time played, gives Longford their day in the sun. They have won the FAI Cup now.
Yep, for the first time in their history as well, and they backed it up a year later, beating Waterford in the final by 2-1. We'll come to that in just a few moments. Barry Ferguson is on the line, and Barry, I'm sorry you had to listen to that, because the penalty miss obviously featured in that, so apologies.
No,
but nonetheless,
problem,
a great day.
Look, I'm well used to it by now, and I deserve all the stick, I guess.
Oh, well, look, you struck it. I mean, in fairness to Adamson, he went the right way. Isn't that it? That's the key, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, look, I'd missed one in the... It was the last minute, nearly an injury time against Pats in the League Cup final, and I sort of practised them on the build-up to the final against Stephen O'Brien and Mick Dempsey, and I was just struggling with where to go. You know, I didn't mind. I wanted to take it, and I was just struggling in my head with where to go, and I sort of changed my mind and didn't strike it again, like they said, with any conviction.
Alan, you took over as manager of Longford Town in 2002. Would you have imagined or envisaged what would follow in 2003 and 2004?
You know, you wouldn't have thought that you'd have been sitting in Lansdowne Road and playing in cup finals. You wouldn't have looked at it that way. What we tried to do was to bring together a cohort of players, young lads, some experienced lads, and we put together a team that we wanted to be competitive in the Premier Division. When I got the Longford job, it was the first time that we had a 10-team Premier Division, and we were everybody's favourites to get relegated that year, because the previous year, Longford had stayed up. I think Stephen made a last-minute penalty save, or the last penalty save in the playoff against Harps. Harps got relegated and Longford stayed up. So everybody had his mark to go down. So my concern as manager was to try and put together a side that would be competitive, stay in the division and hold their own and try and build from there. We did that the first year. And then obviously, as you said, 2003, 2004 came on. But we certainly, that wasn't something that you'd map out. You're just trying to structure a side that would be competitive and more than hold their own in the league.
And how important was Barry in terms of the setup at Longford Town?
Barry was an integral part, and I'm not saying it because he's on the phone there. He'd known Barry when he was at Home Farm. Myself and Dermot Keely had been at Home Farm. Barry had played a couple of games for us as a young teenager and got a move to Coventry City. So I kept in touch with Barry, and he was intimating about coming home. And myself, I think I was at Longford originally with Martin Lawler, and Martin moved on, and we had organised Barry to come down and sign for us. When I got the job, I made Barry the captain. And for a young player, his experience and his kind of drive and his not settling for second best and trying to be excellent at everything that we did, that rubbed off on a lot of players. And it set the standard, and he was an integral part of what we achieved down there for a number of years.
And Barry, a very fine team, as Alan referenced there, including Vinnie Perth, who, of course, we know is doing such wonderful things at the moment with Dundalk, Sean Prunty, Shane Barrett, who got amongst the goals there, Sean Francis as well, and Alan Kirby, who a year later played against his hometown team, Waterford, in the 2004 final and scored. But that Longford team of that era, how do you look back on it?
Yeah, it's a funny one. Like, Vinnie Perth and Alan Murphy would be my two best mates. So, you know, we sort of have a little chat every now and then about the team we had. And sometimes you sort of look back and you name their names. And again, like Alan would tell you how pivotal Philip Keogh was. You know, he was probably an unsung hero at the time, but he was an amazing player. And there were so many. We had a group there for sort of 4 years that were sort of really competitive. And you sort of look back sometimes and go, you know, did we underachieve with the squad we had? And you see what the players went on to do. You know, Kerbs went on to bigger and better teams. Stephen Paisley, Shane Barrett went to full-time football. You know, so Sean Dillon, you know, he had a fantastic career at Dundee. So, you know, there's loads of players that went on. But you look back then and you think of the Shelbourne team and the Bowes team and the Cork team. And, like, again, they were just on a different level. You know, they were sort of just that little bit more consistent and fantastic players. And I'm sure Al would agree, but, like, you never went out on a Friday or Saturday and said, you know, this is a handy 3 points. You know, just every game was competitive. Like, I think Derry were sort of down the bottom for that year, the 2003 year, and again they had some fantastic players, and again it was a horrible place to go and play, a really tough place to go and play up in the Brandywell, to dig out results. But we did. We had a really, really good team, and it was a really good time. But just you look back and sort of go, could we have pushed on? But then you look at the other teams and the players that played with the Shells and the Cork and the Balls and stuff, and they were just amazing.
I'm actually going to, Barry, I'm going to stick up for you here now in this cup final. Number one, you can't practice penalties against the man monster that was Stephen O'Brien in goal. Like, that's just unfair. Like, do you know what I mean? You're obviously going to score every penalty against him. And number two, Eric Levine had an empty net and didn't score late in the game as well. And nobody ever mentions that. So I'm sticking up for Barry on that one.
Yeah, look, and to be fair, like, Stephen O'Brien was like, you could barely score a goal on him in training, you know? So, one of the best things about the team was, you know, we had Stephen O'Brien in goal, and he was probably one of the best keepers in the league for my period at Longford, and anyway. And then we had Sean Francis, we had Shane Barrett, we had Eric Levine who brought us goals at key time. We weren't the most free flowing of goal scoring teams, but you know, we got key goals at key times, and again then we had sort of a good sort of spine defence to the team that we didn't concede that many goals.
Alan, I'd love to know what was going through your mind in the last few minutes off the final, because as James mentioned there, Eric Levine hit the post because Pats were pressing for an equalising goal. Their goalkeeper, Adamson, had come up to join the attack. There was a breakaway. Levine hit the post. Pats went on the attack again, I think, and they got a corner kick and it was cleared. And Longford worked it way all the way up the pitch, and Shane Barrett tapped into an empty net. But it was an extraordinary end to the game. What was going through your mind in the last few moments of that game?
I remember when Eric missed that chance, said to Aaron Callaghan, if we get done here, he's dead. That's a terrible thing to say. But I remember that. We laughed about it afterwards because Philip Kjell, as Barry said, had linked two or three passes up, and he was a superb player for us, a really, really top player who didn't get the recognition maybe that he deserved. But he passed to Eric Levine, and maybe instead of maybe taking responsibility himself, he passed to Levine to tap into an empty net. Levine hit the post and it bounced across. So Pats, as you say, threw everything at us, and Keith Fye, who had a terrific delivery, was whipping in corners. Now, I had every confidence in Barry and in Brian McGovern in that area. Stephen, he was to let the lads go and head everything away, and he'd stay in his line. So I was confident, but Pats had a big side. They had Clive Delaney, Kieran Foley, Darren McGuire, Tony Board, Paul O'Sam. They had an advantage on us. So it was the only area that we were somewhat, you know, under pressure under. And then the keeper came up. So I wasn't a bag of nerves per se, but I certainly wasn't cool. I know inside I would have been hoping that we would get hold of the ball and play our way out and clear our lines and get out and squeeze it. And it shows the composure that Brian McGovern had and that the players actually had on that day. The ball came across, and I think Brian sidestepped someone on the edge of the box, and instead of clearing it down the line, he slipped one in to either Philip Kjell, I don't remember, or I don't know who it was, and then Lake is away, and then Shane Barrett's away, and we score. But the players kept their composure throughout that game, even when Barry missed the penalty. I think that was just before half-time. And there was no issue about it at half time. There was no discussion about we'd missed the chance here. We weren't arrogant. We were extremely confident in our ability and in our mindset going into that game. that once we gave our all and once we played to our ability, that we could get the right result. And that, thankfully, it happened. But the last couple of minutes, I would say I was extremely agitated, but tried my best not to show.
Okay. And Barry, when the full-time whistle went, how sweet was that moment?
Yeah, look, it was brilliant. And again, like, there was a big build-up to it. We had played Pats in the cup final from probably about 2 months earlier. And I remember having a conversation with Jim Hanley that night after sort of missing the penalty and saying, we'll win the FAI, you know, we'll win the FAI Cup. And we sort of had a little laugh. But I think as a team, we genuinely felt we could do it. But there was a lot of emotion in us as well, and it was my first experience of like, a lot of the build up was a mental build up. You know, we had loads of games and stuff like that, but mentally Al had us focused, and his coaching staff had us focused. Al, I think you gave out books to the group.
Yeah,
we had a little H imprinted on the number of our jerseys. You know, just as a little sort of a little mental sort of focus, you know. So there was a big build up to it, and we were so ready for that game. And I think it was probably our best performance of the whole cup run. You know, we went 1-0 down against Tolka after about 20 seconds. You know, so it was probably our best performance. So there was a lot of release of emotions, I'd say. After the cup final, and again, even more for myself, I didn't want to cost the team a second time, you know. So the lads sort of dug me out with that as well. So, but it was an amazing, amazing, amazing time, amazing game.
Alan, can I just ask you about Vinnie Perth? Because obviously, as Barry mentioned there, he's good pals, so it'd be unfair to ask him. But when you were managing Vinnie Perth back then, did you see perhaps the budding shoots of a potential coach of the future? What was he like around the dressing room, or was he just like one of the lads, or did he show inclinations towards management, do you think?
Finney was very popular with the group. He was a deep thinker of the game, and he, you know, we would question certain things around training and the benefit of this piece of training or that piece of training. He was fully committed to every session that he participated in. He always tried to leave everything out on the pitch, on the training ground as well as on the pitch. And I think he says it himself, like, that he technically wasn't maybe one of the best players, but in relation to doing a defensive midfield job and stopping other people playing and keeping the ball going to the likes of a Philip Keogh, he was brilliant for us. In that particular cup final, I think Pat said Paul O'San and Keith Fahey maybe in the middle, and we had Philip and Vinny, and we dominated in there. And to look at Vinny as a manager now is brilliant, and he deserves great recognition because he plays down the part that he's played in Dundalk's success. I wouldn't have said I'd have seen him going through to be a league winning manager, but he certainly was not a follower. He was a leader, and he tried to set the tone. And himself and Barry, it's funny, himself, Barry and Alan Murphy, would have, you know, they would have set down standards, high standards at training. And the likes of Sean Dillon, Shane Barrett, Graham Gartland, when he came to us, they all kind of got in line with the kind of the tech, not just every session that we trained was played at a high intensity. We had good senior pros in Stephen O'Brien and Sean Francis coming to us from Rovers. Brian McGovern came to us from Pat. So there was a mismatch from different sources, but they all brought the standard very, very high. And Vinny was one of the leaders of that. So in that regard, you could certainly say that he showed managerial prowess from that particular period.
And Alan, you're back then again a year later, beating Waterford in the final. Terrific come-from-behind win for Longford against Waterford. Willie Bruton had given Waterford the lead, but it was a final not without controversy. You might just remind people about what happened on the day.
Yeah, we won 2-1 in the end, which is the most important thing. We didn't play well. We had played brilliantly in the semi-final. We drew 0-0 with Drogheda in Longford, and that took us up to United Park, where they were firm favourites to go through. John Martin scored the first one, I think, and Sean Dillon got one of the goals of the season. A terrific goal. We beat them 2-1, and that was a really, really big performance for us. So we were confident going into the final. Barry unfortunately picked up a yellow card, I think, in the semi-final and was suspended. So we had to realign the team. Graeme Gartland and Sean Dillon played centre-back, and Sean Prunty, I think, played left-back. Didn't play particularly well. It wasn't a free-flowing game. There wasn't as big a crowd as there was in the Pats match. And we went the goal down, and we never really looked like creating anything. And I remember juggling Aaron on the line, and we do this, we do that, do the other. I don't know what way we panned out, but probably made a couple of changes towards the latter part of the game, and we got a break. Ball fell to Alan Kirby and he stuck it away. I didn't see the second ball on the pitch. I had no idea what it was or what people were talking about after the game because I didn't see it. And then at that stage, we had again done a lot of mental work with the team and focusing for the 95, 96 minutes that you could be on the pitch and keep plugging away, keep playing. And we got an opportunity, a couple of passes we strung through and the ball fell to Paul Keegan. Dan Connor probably made a bad decision to come out to try and narrow the angle. And Paul, that was his first goal for us. And Paul was a terrific professional, a really, really good fella. But for whatever reason, and Barry might support me on this, it never happened for him at Longford. It just never did. And he came from Bowes, they'd won the league, and we thought he'd be maybe one of the pieces in the jigsaw to push us. We were always, I think, the best of the part-time clubs, falling in behind the full-time teams like Shells, Bowes, Cork, Pats. We got into the top four and we wanted to try and push. That particular year didn't work for Paul. And I think his celebration and the emotion again that flowed when he scored was plain for all to see. So very, very, you know, a surreal situation. And I remember actually when we scored the equaliser, I saying, right, we'll take a draw here and we'll go to a replay and we'll get Barry will come back in. I was half thinking of this, never thinking that we'd go and get a second goal, to be perfectly honest with you. Thankfully it happened.
Yeah, you talked there about Paul Keegan. Remember that celebration in particular? I remember people talking on the day of the match as well, thinking, you know, if anything's going to fall for him, it'll fall for him today. And then when he puts the ball in the back of the net, I think we were talking to Johnny Glynn last week, the celebration was kind of akin to that, the way he reels off. And the emotion in it is just unbelievable. But then you just think, hang on a second, this is 2 years in a row. Longford Town have gone and won the cup. They're now cup specialists. So the fever running through the town was immense after that.
Also, I think that to say it, we'd won the League Cup about 6 weeks earlier down in Longford. We played Bohemians and we were absolutely excellent. We were really, really good and fully deserved. And this was a bold side. I think Stephen Kenny had gone at this stage. Gareth Farrelly might have been the manager. Gary held it maybe. And there was a hunger to be successful. And we played in the Setanta Cup. We'd big game experience playing up in Windsor Park, playing Linfield, playing Glentoran, beating the two of them in Longford. So, those players had good experience of playing on big stages and they didn't get frazzled. But you're right, to actually put it into context, for Longford to win the Cup 2 years in a row was a great achievement and is lost on, I suppose, a lot of us that were involved in it at the time.
And Barry, unfortunately, you missed out through suspension, but I'm sure you're backing the lads all the way in the decider.
Yeah. It was. It was a tough one. We played Drogheda in the replay on the Tuesday, and I got a phone call, I think, from the secretary on the Wednesday morning just to say that, the yellow card sort of counted and I was out for the final. I was devastated personally, but again, Alan kept me involved. We did all the same press as we did the year before, so I was sort of rolled out to do all that and we sort of kept everything the same. And like Graeme Gartland wouldn't have played too much with Sean Dillon at centre back, so Alan did a lot of work with them and the staff did a lot of work with them lads and got them ready for the cup final. But just for Longford Town, again, when I joined, if you got a draw or people were sort of generally happy. By the time, my stint came to an end, if the best Shelbourne team in history bet you 2-0 at home or away, people were asking questions, so there was a total sort of shift from a club perspective and a supporter perspective as well, which was great. They weren't just happy to get the cup finals and stay in the league. The whole club genuinely wanted to push everything forward.
Speaking of Longford, I don't know if you noticed, a couple of nights ago I saw something on the internet that I thought would actually break the internet, because it refers to Longford Town and their promotion celebration in 20 years ago, right? And the current Dundalk manager, who we've been referring to, Vinnie Peart, dancing on the streets with Peggy Coyle. I don't know if you remember Peggy Coyle, mother of former Longford player Robbie Coyle. And this was outside the Commodore Hotel in Cove, County Cork in 2000. And to describe the pictures for you, Vinnie is doing a kind of a hybrid of an Irish dance. He's wearing his going out shoes and possibly a tracksuit bottoms and a Longford Town top. And his his pants are rolled up towards his knees. And now it's gone into a kind of a hoedown sort of dance. So, yeah, those were the days, all right, where Longford Town ruled supreme around the country.
That's the way you normally go, Joe.
I think one of the best memories I have of that whole experience was the first cup when we went back to Longford and Barry. You might remember the whole. It was as if everybody in the county came into the town square to meet us, and we came down on a coach, and we were taken off a coach and put onto a kind of an open top bus. And that night in particular, I've never seen that type of crowd gather in Longford, and it was a brilliant night to share it with a bunch of supporters who, as Barry was saying, were you know, fed maybe. Morsels and the scraps to stay in the league or to get the odd result here and there. And obviously getting promotion when Stephen was there was a huge thing back in, as you say, 2000, whatever the year was, 98 rather. And for us to then go back and bring something to the club, that's a real tangible reward. And it was great recognition for those people who are still working at the club, the supporters of the club, still at the club. But to go back to Longford that particular night, that first one, that was something that I will always remember.
Okay, well said. Great times for Longford Town, and of course great people, as you mentioned, they're involved with the club right to this very day. Alan Matthews, Longford Town manager of that cup winning side of 2003 and 2004, and Barry Ferguson, skipper of Longford Town all those years ago. Many thanks for joining us and reminiscing. Tony O'Donoghue, I have a kesht for you. I have a question for you.
Kesht to one.
Because, yeah, were you in your youth, because, you know, you're not that young now, Tony. were you a Cork Celtic or a Cork Hibs boy?
You see, there's a story to this.
Go on.
Where I live, it would be much closer to Turner's Cross than to Flower Lodge. And of course, Turner's Cross was where Cork Celtic played, and Flower Lodge was where Cork Hibs played. But having said that, the number 10 bus stopped very close to our house, and it went all the way out to Ballinlock and stopped outside Flower Lodge. And it was actually, if you could scrape together the price of the bus fare, it was easier to get to Flower Lodge, which was always, in the days of Cork Hibs as well, the great theatre. I mean, people always say that it had the best playing surface in the country and one of the best playing surfaces in Europe. And thanks to the number 10 bus and 2 shillings and 6 pence probably, because yes, I am that old. Yeah, I would have seen Cork Hibs a bit more than Cork Celtic in those days.
So how was the city divided between Cork Celtic and Cork Hibernians? It wasn't a north side, south side thing, or was it?
No, I wouldn't have thought so, no. I mean, there was a great rivalry because they each had great players. They had brilliant matches, and it was in the days when we were getting massive crowds in League of Ireland. So, yeah, and Cove Ramblers were non-league at the time, but they were around as well, of course. So there was massive rivalry. It would be akin to, you know, Shell's Bowes sort of situation or Bowes Rovers. But I wouldn't have said it was a cross river as such, no.
Okay, great sides, a great time for Cork football, of course, Cork Hibs, Cork Celtic, and later on in the decade, in the 70s, Albert Rovers emerged from the demise of Cork Hibernians. Looking back on that period, Cork-based journalist now, Noel Spillane.
Well, Adrian, I'll give you a potted history of the three clubs. Now, unfortunately, extinct. We'll start with Cork Hibernians. They won the Shield in 1969, the Blacksmith Cup, the League in 1971, and then back-to-back FAI Cups in 1972 and 73. under the late Dave Bicuzzi, who sadly passed away last week. Hibs were the most successful of the three clubs we feature tonight from that golden era of Cork soccer in the 1970s. Unfortunately, Hibs folded in 1976 and the players were told of their demise while on tour in America. A number of protest marches followed around town to try and save the club and have Dave Bicuzzi reinstated, but again, I'm afraid it was all to no avail. Moving to Cork Celtic, they won their one and only league title in 1974 under the great Paul O'Donovan, who was affectionately known as the Golden Boy, when he, along with players like Ben Hennigan, Alfie Hale and Bobby Tambling, thrilled the crowds at Turner's Cross. They too were great days indeed. And again, Celtic sadly went out of football in 1979. And then we move to the third Cork club in our featured podcast. We have Albert Rovers, who were also known as Cork Alberts and Cork United. And they all flew the League of Ireland flag in Leaside from 1976 to 1982. They had six seasons in the lower half of the table, but they had a reputation as a knockout cup team. In 1978, they got to the League Cup final, losing to Dundalk after a penalty shootout. And then a year later, they were back in the FAI Cup semi-finals, but again lost narrowly to Dundalk. After Cork United's demise, we had a two-year gap with no League of Ireland football in Cork before the Avondale United pair of Jim Hennebury and Chris Hurley stepped in and floated Cork City in 1984. So now I leave it up to Carla, Sonny and John Bourne to put some meat on the bones.
Okay, well, let's do that. Noel Spillane, many thanks for that. We're joined by Carl Davenport and also by Sonny Sweeney, a Cork Hibernians legend. And shortly, we'll be joined by John Brown, who also played for Cork Hibs and other Cork outfits as well. But great to have you on the line. I guess we should start, Sonny, with Dave Bicuzzi, the sad passing of Dave Bicuzzi, because he's such a central part of that time. His departure, his demise last week. I'm sure, like so many people throughout football in this country, you were very sad to hear the news.
Yeah, it was a great guy, was Dave, not. As I say, he come to Cork Hibs in 1970. As I say, before that, Austin Noonan was the manager. And he made his more professional and more attitude towards the game. You know, his training methods were, everything was on the watch. So we used to train on the quarry at Fleur Lodge on a Tuesday morning. And every one of the runs, whether it was up and down a hill or round the side of the quarry, was all timed, you know. So even when we were training the doggies, the sprints, everything was on the watch now. We were as fit as a fiddle. I was never as fit as I was when, I mean, I was a pro for 16 years, but when I played at Hibs and that, I mean, his training methods were smashing. I mean, I look at the games that we played. We had Marsden, Tony Marsden, Maya Dennehy and David Wigginton up front, who were all like Olympic sprinters, you know. So they complemented the rest of the team in that, with the Irish boys at the back, Martin Sheehan, Noel Amani. The training that Bicuzzi put us through was fantastic. He reminds me of the Leeds manager, Bielsa, because what he's done, he's come in and done the same thing to Leeds United, got them super fit, and they do have a high press on teams and that, you know. So it's the same sort of thing that Bicuzzi had done at Cork Hibs and that. I mean, the first game we had against Mönchengladbach, he got a dozier from Harry Catterick, who was the Everton manager. And it wasn't very good about Mönchengladbach. We weren't a very good side and all this. So we went out and I tried to attack them. 11 international players, you know, Gunther Netz and Bertie Volks and people like this. And they hammered us 5-0 at Fleur Lodge. So in the away game, we revised our tactics and that. We tightened everything up and they beat us 2-1. You know, he was right precise in what he done was, Dave. You know, but the good thing about Dave was he done the same thing as all the other players. When we trained, he done the same thing. So you'd be absolutely on your knees, you know, but he was doing the same thing, so you couldn't complain. You know, it brought a lot more professionalism towards our game in Cork. You know, I had a lot of time for him. I thought he was a good coach and a good manager. I wouldn't say anything bad about David. As I say, it'd be sadly missing that.
Absolutely. Carl Davenport is also with us, who played for both clubs, really, Cork Celtic and Cork Hibernians. Carl, how do you look back on that rivalry in the early 70s between Cork Celtic and Cork Hibernians, having played for both clubs?
Well, I mean, it was great. I mean, when I arrived over there in January in 67, both clubs were bottom of the league and only getting 500 people at games. The first game I played in was for Cork Celtic and Cork and Burnies at Flower Lodge. And I thought, that's a decent ground. We won 2-1. I scored the winner. And on the Tuesday night, went over to Turner's Cross to train. And I walk in and I see the ground. And I said, this is the worst training ground I've ever seen in my life. And they said, well, this is where you play on Sundays. I thought, what have I let myself in for? But I got about 14 goals in 13 games, and we got off the bottom of the league, and we finished about mid-table. Anyway, when they made me manager in 1968, I was only 23, and which the crowds came back, and we were getting 16,000 every home match, an extra 2,000 on the gate when we played away. We finished second to Shamrock Rovers. And I still believe that we would have won that league, but the day before we played Shamrock Rovers in a more or less about five games to go, on the Saturday, a young lad at dinner time ran in between two cars. He'd been to the shop for his mum and dad, and he ran in front of my car, and I knocked him down, and he was in a coma for 3 or 4 weeks. And I missed the train up to Dublin, and all the lads knew what had happened. And anyway, the directors came for me, got me out of bed, and took me up 100 mile an hour in a car. And when I togged off to play, the lads were glad to see me. You know, it was a big match.
Yeah.
I only lasted till half time. I was sick as a dog and everything. We only finished a couple of points behind Rovers in joint second. So that was after the first season. We were bottom of the league and this, that, the other, and it had improved so much. And then other English people or Scottish people started coming over. But I was like the first one over there. And they didn't do much training. They weren't professional. But when I took over, I started doing new training regimes. Like, I'd pick the best training from all the clubs I've been at and put them all together. We had Parloff running, pulse rates checked and everything. And believe me, that team, what I had, it was as fit as... They'd never been as fit in their life. And Jackie Morley, who played for Waterford, I let him train with us, and he said I prolonged his career another 3 or 4 years. They were great days, and I love Celtic. Well, obviously, but I like Tibbs as well. And when I moved from, when it was a record, when the Ibs bought me from Celtic, the crowd didn't bother. And then I went back to Celtic again. It's just a wonderful place at that particular period.
And another player associated primarily with Cork Celtic, Bobby Tamling, who, you know, was very close to making England squad that won the World Cup in 66. He was part of the Cork Celtic side that won the league title in 1974. And that too, no more than Cork Hibs in the previous years, was a terrific team, Carl.
Great, great team. Bobby Tamlin once, he was a Jehovah's Witness, and he said to me, do you want to be a Jehovah's Witness? And I said, I never saw the accident. But he was a nice fellow. He lived down Kinsale, near me, actually. But that's how it was. We played a game when I was at Cork Celtic as manager. We played CYM in Dublin in a cup match. And it was only a little ground. There was only a minor club. And it was no score. And I always remember it was raining. The last minute, this ball comes over and I stuck an header at the back of the net and we won 1-0. Going down on the train, the directors give me such a bollocking. They said, we wanted a replay. Why did you miss that? They wanted the replay. They didn't want to win the game, but in the last minute, they wanted the money from the replay at Turner's Cross. I couldn't believe it. They went mad. And I thought I'd done well getting the winner. There were all sorts of things like that. I mean, our directors were... At Celtic, there were three cattle dealers, and but they did well for the club, and I was on great money. I think when I went over to Celtic, I think I was on £90 a week, which was a lot of money then, tax-free. My digs were only £5 a week, three meals a day, and all my washing and ironing done. I think I'll move back. But you had that much money to spend, it was like being a millionaire. And I just said, I'm going to have a good time, because by the time I'm 40, I'll end up on a park bench. And when I were 40, all the benches were full. It was like being over there. It was like, it was just beautiful. I'd never been to Ireland in my life before. When Alan Ball's father fixed me up to go to Celtic from Macclesfield, I'd scored 51 the season before. And then in January, before the season finished, when I went to Ireland, I'd already scored 57. And he said, I'd never been to Ireland. I didn't know where Cork was or nothing. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, I've told them that you'll get them a goal a game, but they're getting a playboy of the Western world rolled into one.
This is why the Dav is an absolute legend in Cork to this day, and glad to hear him sounding so well. Carl, can you tell me why the Dave Bacuzzi situation in Cork became such a controversy? I mean, he brought such success to Cork Hibs, and then they got rid of him.
I have to tell the truth. He didn't really like me being there. Ambi Folk, they bought me from Cork Celtic after that fantastic season we had. They bought me, they paid a club record fee, and was probably on more money than him. And I didn't get on well with him at all. I heard Sonny said about going up the quarry and all this and all this training. Yeah, that were great, but you've got to train with the ball as well, which we never did get it much ball work. We were like just a bunch of runners. But all the lads in that Hibernians team, they were fantastic lads. They all pulled together and with a great team spirit. At the end of the day, I left. I'd had enough of him, and I went back and managed Cork Celtic, the player manager at Cork Celtic again. But after that, after me leaving, another 2 years after, they'd gone out of the league. So I think there's a lot of, you can pick things out of that, that I honestly think that he didn't really do what he should have done at the end. He thought he could let me go and this, that and the other. But he didn't realise There were a lot of gate money be going with me going, and Celtic were happy with the situation. It was unbelievable. I mean, when I left Hibs to go back, when I left Celtic at first to go to Hibs, there was they had about £6,000 fee on me, which had never been heard of. So I'm back in England, my mother and father. Cork Celtic are paying me wages. Hibs are paying me wages. I was hoping they'd never sort it out. But eventually the league reduced the fee, and I went to Cork Hibernians. But I was disappointed at Cork Hibernians. They seemed to think that, you can't be letting a player like me go to this, that and the other. People come to watch you, and people did come to watch me because I was controversial. I got great goals. I'd done nothing wrong, but he didn't seem to like that.
It was Hibbs' most successful time, you have to say. And after Cork Hibs, he went on to manage Home Farm, indeed. And they won the FAI Cup in 1975. He coached the likes of Ronnie Whelan before his departure to Liverpool. So, and because he coached an Irish Olympic team as well, so he definitely had something. I remember meeting him in his later life. He went on to own a very successful travel agency, and I met him when he was living and working in
That's
Dublin.
Right.
And a lovely man, must be said. But you had your times with him, and you had some incredible times in Cork, the Dav, I have to say. Great to hear your stories.
Carl, many thanks for joining us on the podcast. Sonny is still with us, and very shortly we'll be joined by John Brown. James, Tony mentioned there Dave Bacuzzi winning the cup with Home Farm in 1975, and you've got a connection to that, haven't you?
I have a slight connection, thanks to my
slight
better looking half, my wife. Yeah, her uncle played on that team, Joe Smith. He was part of that Home Farm team that Dave was the manager of, along with Dermot Keeley and them guys in there. Joe was part of that Home Farm winning team that caused an awful upset, beating Shelburne in the final. And I've looked and I've looked and I've looked so many times to get the match from, but I can't. It's not in our archive, unfortunately. But he did tell me that Shells had been on a promise for a good win bonus that day. And of course, it got get home farm. They were expected to win it. And there was absolute uproar in the home dressing room, as it were, at that time at Damon Park when they lost. It caused an awful upset it into them.
We'll be chatting to John Braun momentarily, but Sonny Sweeney is still with us. Sonny, when you look back at that time, and obviously we heard there from Carl Davenport, who was such a terrific player, but who stood out for you? I mean, there were so many fine players. Bobby Tambling we mentioned as well. But if you had to pick one or two players, who would you pick from either side, Celtic or Hibernians?
Johnny Matthews was a good player. Peter Thomas, they were at Waterford, and that. They were very good players in that. You know, I mean, we had some smashing players at Cork, Hibs and that. You say Dav, you talk to Dav, he was the best player. with Wiggy, he was at Meyer. Wiggy, Meyer and Tony Marsden, who were up front for the latter part of Cork Hibs, they were smashing. They were quick as anything. They used to help you out. But John Lawson, myself, and Jerry Finnegan were the midfield players. They used to chase back and help you out in defending, and they were great athletes. And I put it down to a lot of the training. And as I say, Carroll had his differences with Bicozzi, but I was quite happy with Bicozzi because we were winning, we were doing well, we had a good team spirit within the club. He had his job to do, and I was quite happy with that. You know, I wouldn't say much against him in that, you know, because he made us really fit. As Carl says, he didn't use a lot, we didn't have a lot of ball work in that, but we were as fit as a fiddle. The boys in the team were with great pace, and a lot of the boys were very technical, and we had a lot of hard players in the club as well. John Herrick, Martin Sheehan, Noel Manny, they were smashing players. I mean, that Cork side that we had was very good. There wasn't many teams beat us. As I say, in the last 20 minutes of games, you used to be well in top because the teams are flagging, because we kept up this high press that we worked on. You know, so as I say, I've got a lot of time for Bicozzi and that. I thought he'd done well for Cork Hibs. When I first went over with Cal and Tommy Henderson picked me up at Dublin Airport. I keep saying this, in a 1954 vintage Rolls Royce took me back to Cork and that, you know. So I actually lived with Carroll for a period of time and that. As I say, I had a job and he was out nightclubbing at night. That, you know, a lot of good stories to tell on that, you know.
Well, John Braun is another member of that Cork Hibs era, is on the line. John, we've been chatting away. We had Carl Davenport, who played for both Hibs but primarily made his name really at Cork Celtic. But you chose Cork Hibernians over Cork Celtic at the time when you had to make a decision. How did you arrive, or how did you decide on Hibs as opposed to Celtic?
Well, it was back in 1966, I think, and I think I had brought Bobby, my brother, was playing with Cork Hibernians at the time, and so I automatically joined up in 1966, 67.
And happy memories of the time with Cork Hibernians, because as we mentioned, enjoyed so much success under the late Dave Bicozzi.
It was, and I'd like to express my condolences to Dave's family too under the recent bereavement, but fantastic times, and He was an exemplary professional. Everything he was doing was a great attention to detail. We had some fantastic, successful days with him.
And what about the rivalry with Cork Celtic? Was it a big rivalry, or was it just, you know, two clubs getting on with things in the one city?
Oh no, there was huge rivalry, and they were very tense, the games, and we were all great friends. But my God, the will to win was unbelievable. Typical Cork spirit, and I think when Celtic went out of footballing, I think it took from the spectacle from the public, because that rivalry was gone. And Cork Alberts at the time, we thought we'd do better with only one club there, but it was the opposite, because the rivalry was gone when Celtic went. But there was a great atmosphere at all the local derbies.
And Tony mentioned a little earlier as well, Flower Lodge. The name just evokes so many memories as a venue. You know, when I was young, hearing the name Flower Lodge on the radio, it just evoked all kinds of magical connotations. And as Tony mentioned as well, the playing surface by reputation was supposed to have been something else at Flower Lodge back in the day.
Oh, it was fantastic. And then you had the visiting clubs from England, and the oil passed were very, very impressed with it. And it was a fantastic surface. The only thing about it up in the city end, it was get a bit bogged down in the wet weather, but overall it was a brilliant pitch.
And when you look back at that time, Cork Celtic, Cork Hibs, the big crowds at Turner's Cross, the big crowds at Flower Lodge, do you think to yourself, well, it'd be great if we still had that today, maybe two clubs in Cork City? Obviously for any club now, it's about survival, and Cork City are forging their own particular path. But as you mentioned, perhaps Cork misses that rivalry that Celtic and Hibs brought.
Yeah, but the only thing about that is that in Cork, we tend to follow a lot of sports. You get a lot of the same public that will visit GAA matches, rugby matches and soccer. And I think there is room for two clubs there. But hopefully someday that there might be another club come into it. Because we could do with that rivalry. I think there's nothing like a local derby for atmosphere.
OK, well, listen, many thanks for joining us. That's John Braun. Before that, of course, Sonny Sweeney and also Carl Davenport, just reflecting on that great time in Cork football. And we leave you today with Dave Bakuzzi's mantra, actually. And he said, life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass. It's about learning to dance in the rain. Thanks to Tony O'Donoghue, also to James O'Toole. We'll be back with an earlier than usual edition of the RTÉ Soccer Podcast this coming Friday. Until then, bye-bye.